Tá.
You're living here in München? Could you tell me whether you use the metro often?
Yeah, mostly I use electric car or S-Bahn or also underground.
And is it important that a city has a subway like this one?
Yes, a city like Munich is very important to have an underground, sure.
Why?
Yeah, because of we have very much traffic and too much cars, and so it's very easy and also very cheap to go by underground.
Okay, and what would have happened if there was no subway here?
We have much more traffic, much more cars, and we have not enough space.
When did you get the subway?
To the Olympic Games 1972.
That's a long time ago.
Yes.
How many inhabitants do you think a city needs in order to have a subway?
I think over 1 million. You can start with an underground.
Okay, and how many has München got?
1.2, 1.3, so it's...
Thank you very much. Could you tell me whether you use the subway often?
Yes.
You do. Why do you use this?
She is very good.
Why is she good?
Why is she is fast and... Yeah, fast.
So you get from one place very fast to another place of the city, is that correct?
Yes.
Do you think that every big city needs one?
Yes.
Yes? Okay. Do you know where we are now? Is this Hauptbahnhof? No? Oh, okay. How old are you?
I'm 12.
12. Could you imagine this city without a subway?
Yes.
Yes? How would the city look without a subway?
Shit.
Why would it be shit, the city, without if there was no subway?
No city.
Say it in German.
Sie wäre dann keine Stadt, weil es einfach und U-Bahn sehr unpraktisch wäre.
So the city would be very unpractical and unhandy if there was no U-Bahn, and you wouldn't consider it a real city, and you need to get out now. Thank you very much. Can you tell me your name?
My name is Lucas.
Thank you, Lucas. This little boy just told me that without a subway, he couldn't imagine any city. It would just be shit, and it wouldn't be a real city. So we are in the Hauptbahnhof of Munich. It's a quite complex system, the system here. You have some lines that are called S lines and U lines, and I have just seen 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, I think there are something like 17 lines at least, but they go in all directions. So okay, so I'm going now with the U2 to Josefplatz. Some food, but finer food or something. One and two. Oh, that's S. I'm on the right wrong one again. Holy moly. Sprechen Sie auch Englisch? Nein. Von wie lange bis wie lange verkaufen Sie hier Zeitungen?
Ja. Das ist für ein Radio hier in Dublin?
Nein, das muss ich selber halten. Wie viele Stunden sitzen Sie hier, um Zeitungen zu verkaufen?
Dankeschön, salamat. Ma avronasum, az kabelasum, bale hubasum, zu bale.
Ja.
No idea what he was talking. There are a lot of foreigners here in Germany. And I see that I hope I'm going to the right side now. Okay, you're just bringing down a bike. Are you going to put that bike on the metro here?
Yeah,
do you pay?
Intend to.
Do you
yes,
pay
I pay for it, yeah.
How much do you pay?
One stripe for the bicycle, one okay. For me.
How would the city look like if there was no subway?
Much more traffic on the surface, yeah. I think.
Because Dublin doesn't have any subway and we have loads of cars in the city. How often do you use this subway?
I use it quite often, every 2 days.
Going to work or something, or just going into the city? Or
yeah, going to work.
Side of the city, to the outskirts.
Yeah, I look at the maze. This is really a huge network, and I'm thinking of the cost that would involve to make it. And I know that's the reason that we don't have it in Dublin, because people don't want to spend the money they could spend on other things. So, but they did it here.
Just know that lately they finished the route to the airport. Mm. That was the last thing I. No, and to
that's funny. In Dublin, that's the first one they want to make. What's a clue about some lines? Are U lines? Other are S lines? U meaning underground or something? And S.
S-Bahn is also on the surface, and U-Bahn is only.
U-Bahn is just in the metro and the city area, and the S-Bahn goes outside of Munich. Okay. You see.
Yeah, I didn't do that analysis yet. Thank you very much. Could you just state your first name and maybe your age?
I'm Frank, and I'm 29.
I'm Petra, and I'm 31.
Okay, thank you both. Yeah, bye.
Bye.
So this one is a bit more newer, we're going into now, and hoping that I'm on the right one, because I didn't check that yet. But I think so. So it's this sign. There's Moching, yeah, we are on the right one. Great. Well, it took me half an hour at least to get here by subway. Maybe because I wasn't the handiest person to do it, and because it's quite late, so they're not going that frequent anymore. But you have the feeling it goes fast. Now I'm going to where my restaurant is, and it's now 10:30, so I hope it's going to work. And it did work. I got my dinner at 10:30 something, which is kind of hard in many cities in the world, but in Germany you can eat whenever you want, it seems. This was from a week I had in Munich last week, and we're going to hear some more from that from an American guy and from a German guy, and the last one is on a tram, and the trams are wonderful in Germany, because this was recorded at 3 o'clock at night, and I don't even think it was a Friday or a Saturday night, it was just an ordinary weekday night. So there's some inspiration for Dublin city planners. And now we're going to hear some German music, because we're still in Germany, and it's called the band is called Wir sind Helden, and the song is called Von hier an blind, so we are heroes, and the song is called From Here We Are Blind. Von zwei Füßen, die nichts sagen, außer
at the dinner and we ate the dinner, and I got the chance to speak with Greg Roach, who is well, famous in some regions. He's famous under the people who make computer games. He's an American guy, but he has a nice perspective for an American guy, I think. And well, we often have kind of a stereotype of Americans, and this man has something to say, and I think he's talking about a new media form we don't have a lot of attention to. So I hope you enjoy what he has to say.
Greg, you're from the States, and you're just saying something about consumption.
Yeah, I was just talking about the fact that in the West, we have kind of mindless, unconscious patterns of consumption, because we don't think about where things come from, how they're made, and generally speaking. And we don't attribute any real value to that. All of, most of the goods that we consume in the West are just commodities. And so we stay in a constant loop, a constant cycle of consumption where you buy a cheap good. And this, you know, this is facilitated by cheap oil, by the interests of very large international corporations who have goods manufactured abroad using very cheap labor. They transport it very cheaply. You buy it very cheaply. You consume it, use it for a short period of time, and then you throw it away. And that's a cycle that I think is peculiar to the modern world. Not very long ago, so much of our economy and so many of the goods that we used or consumed, if you will, were built on kind of a craft basis. And maybe, in all likelihood, you probably knew the person that made the shoes that you were wearing. Or the, oh, no, I won't. Thank you. You knew the person who made the shoes that you were wearing or the shirt that you were wearing. You knew the person who had killed the food and cleaned it and butchered it that you were eating. And I just believe that our basic orientation towards the things that we need to live was very different. And so I think there was a degree of sustainability in that way of living that we have lost. And so the fact that the needs, or rather the interests, of very large multinational conglomerates are being served by meeting a false set of needs, which are based on this endless cycle of consumption. Disposable goods, you know, our food. You go to the grocery store, you buy hamburger meat or pieces of chicken already cut up. It's become such an abstraction. You forget the fact that an animal gave its life so that you can have that meal. You forget the fact that human hands have touched that food all along the way until it got there all shrink-wrapped and nice and pretty for you. And so in that instance, and you know, as an example, what that has resulted in is the idea of corporate farming, corporate butchering. Animals live in terrible conditions. They're fed antibiotics and growth hormone, etc. And no one is aware of that reality. We're not aware of what goes into producing that nice, convenient little package of chicken. And as we become aware of this, our ideas about where and how we eat, you know, what we wear, how long we keep it, what its utility is, what its value is, they start to shift, and our patterns of consumption shift. And this has really profound implications for global sustainability going forward. It has profound implications for the distribution of wealth, which I think is one of the prime drivers of a lot of the unrest and the discontent that we find in the modern world. I have a really good friend in Egypt. He was telling me not long ago that life in Egypt has changed so much in the past 5 to 10 years, primarily because of their exposure to media, that Egyptian people in the countryside, you know, wherever, that they lived the same way for thousands of years, and that they were perfectly happy in that. And that then when they get exposed to media, whether it's Western media or other media, it doesn't matter. They get exposed to media and it creates a desire in them that cannot be fulfilled in the life that generation upon generation was fulfilled by before. And so you get young generations who grow up wanting more. They want a high-definition television. They want a car. They're not going to have the economic means to achieve that where they're at. So they leave their village. They leave their family. The traditional way of life dies off. They go to the city where there's not an economic infrastructure to fully support them. You know, and then all of the problems of modern urban life begin to happen. In this specific instance, this becomes then a breeding ground for radical Islam because of the discontent that they experience. They're exposed to these things, and it's all about consumption, primarily. It's all about consumerism. They can't get these things. There's a dissatisfaction that drives them out of a pattern that has been satisfying, you know, to previous generations, and drives them into a circumstance where they can't possibly find the satisfaction that they're seeking. So, you know, they're one of the conditions of modern global, you know, politics that all of the Western and the Islamic world as well is facing. You know, there it is in kind of a nutshell. And it all started because one family on the block got a television set and they started seeing commercials that are complete fantasies about how life should be. They're connected with programs that are complete fantasies about how life should be. And this need for wish fulfillment gets born.
So how should television be?
You know, that's a very good question. I don't know that I would feel comfortable really answering that for myself. I mean, one of the problems is not so much about the specific content that we find in media. That's an aspect of it, undeniably. But I think one of the phenomenons, one of the things that happens is you watch a television show, and it's a very idealized representation of life. And then you see an advertisement for a product. And on a very deep, almost unconscious level, there's a connection between those two things. A happy life, a fulfilled life, a glamorous life, an important life, a meaningful life, somehow becomes connected with this product, whatever that product might be. I think it's that mechanism that is one of the primary issues. It's, you know, it's not so much about this kind of content or that kind of content or this kind of show or that kind of show. There are issues in that regard, absolutely. I don't pretend to be smart enough to know how to solve those things. And so much of it becomes very culturally specific. I think one of the problems is that in the West, we have this expertise at creating media, and our media gets exported to so many parts of the world. That expertise and the economic means to do that doesn't live locally. So what they consume are these Western ideas about life and how life should be. So I believe that that's an issue. But again, I don't know how to go about solving that.
Could one use kind of the techniques that are used in advertising for the good goal, kind of for changing the system?
Yeah, I think you can. And I think we've seen some examples of that from time to time. There's an
like what?
Well, there's an advertising campaign that runs in the United States that's about smoking. It's from an organization called Truth.org, and they run highly effective, relatively speaking, large budget advertising campaigns that are about educating people to the truth about smoking. And specifically, they're trying to counter the highly effective manipulation that's being done by the tobacco companies to get people to smoke. So now there's a specific, you know, cause that's been taken on.
You've been teaching about gaming, and you've been producing the X-Files. Could you explain in what sense gaming can be negative as well as positive?
Well, I think that it's an incredibly important new medium, and I think that can be witnessed by the degree of cultural significance that it has in the lives of a lot of people, you know, primarily a younger generation of people, but not exclusively, but also by its degree of economic importance. The worldwide games business has become huge. So it's a very important economic engine in many parts of the world. So that, you know, that just speaks to its significance for us as a society and for us as a culture. I think one of the problems is that we don't really know yet what that means. In a way, it's almost like the automobile as a corollary. 100 years ago, or whenever it was, 70, 80 years ago, somebody invented the automobile, and then we started making them, and people started using them, and then there were more, and then we used it more, and there was never any kind of forethought to what the impact of that technology was going to be, either on the nature and fabric of our society, or on our environment. And now we're waking up to this reality. I live in Los Angeles, which is the city of cars. And it's fascinating to me and very refreshing and reinvigorating to me to come to Europe and to be able to walk down the street and walk past other people and, you know, say good morning and be ignored or whatever the case may be. But to have human contact introduced just into the act of going to the grocery store. In Los Angeles, if I go to the grocery store, I get in my car by myself. I drive there. I'm surrounded by hundreds of thousands of other people who are in their cars. We might be 30 feet apart, but we're completely isolated. And that, I believe, has a profound impact on our psyches and on the very fabric of our culture, on the very fabric of our society.
And under the earth here, there is a mall. And it was the first mall in Munich.
What year was it built?
The 70s. It was at the Olympic Games, huh? They started that, huh? So there was a kidnapping taking place in Germany that was very famous. They kidnapped the son of a very wealthy family who is producing pudding. And the kidnapper, he chose in the city a place where he could get the ransom without being caught by the police. And he found this place in this pedestrian mall, which is down here. Because there are doors who go to the service units, and those doors, at the time, they didn't have handles, so you couldn't enter them. And then he kidnapped the guy. He made a strange construction in the case where he put him in, which implied electricity. But it was too foxy, what he did. Too intelligent, huh? So in the end, by a little mistake, the guy got almost electrocuted in that box. And he, this young guy, he broke his bones, his hip bones, because of that. In the way that could never be repaired again. The guy who was involved, who was organizing the kidnapping, was impersonating four or five different people at the time. He wanted to create the impression in his victim that there are five people involved. He used all his intelligence for that. The ransom was handed to him down in this pedestrian mall at a certain door. And he escaped under the earth, and he surfaced a little bit, a little distance from here. He had a car ready. It was very hard to catch him afterwards. But the police in Bavaria put all the effort that they had and all the manpower that they had to get him. So they got him to a court just over there, the court building. And they were convicting him on proofs, on evidence. He never confessed, huh? And he went to jail for 15 years. They were convinced that after he left jail, that he would go and he would try to change the ransom. Now, the ransom was paid in banknotes that would lose their validity. So they observed him the whole time. And they caught him in London, where he was trying to exchange that money. So they knew that he was the guilty one, but they couldn't get him because he already had been in jail for 15 years. Now, this guy was, in a sense, an ingenious criminal, but it was so immoral what he was doing that he couldn't profit from it. Afterwards, he was writing his memoirs, but the people wouldn't buy the book. And it's interesting because you have a criminal involved there, and sometimes you have cases of criminals that you would identify with, and you would like to read their memoirs. But in his case, even though he had an IQ of 150 and whatnot, you were not buying it because you didn't like him.
What was his motive?
He was evil.
It was just money and...
Yeah. He was just thinking how he could commit, this is what he said, a perfect crime. He was researching on all the crimes that had to do with kidnapping, and he thought that the weak point was the ransom, handing over of the ransom. So he decided to find a perfect way of handing over the ransom, and he researched the city of Munich, and he decided it was this pedestrian wall that he could do it, and it worked out. And what was so hideous about his crime is that he had worked out everything. And the last thing that he decided to do was to pick the victim, the person that he would actually kidnap. And this, by chance, was this particular person, which was Oetker. It's a famous German factory there producing cakes and everything. And it was the son of that family that he kidnapped. So he was an interesting case of a very immoral person. Because he had a very high intelligence, but was completely immoral. And he had a wife, he had children, and they were not aware of his criminal energy. One might think of the bombers one hears today of in London, huh? Where the whole neighborhood says they were not aware that those were criminal people. And we had similar cases like that in Germany. We had criminals who were committing kidnapping, bank robberies, rapes and murders, and living perfect bourgeois life. Like, they had a little house, they had a family, there were a bunch of men, and they got together, and now and then they would commit a crime. Huh?
We're not talking about the political crimes.
No political crimes, they were interested in committing. It was a club. They were doing kidnappings and bank robberies, and they were discovered in a case where they kidnapped the daughter of an industrialist whom they planned to rape and murder afterwards. And they had everything laid out, and it's by a coincidence that it came out. They had a normal life. They had jobs and everything that you would think of a normal bourgeois person. Huh?
So that you didn't need this amount of money, for example?
No, they were committing the crimes because they were interested in crime, in the energy that it would give to their normal life. And they would deposit the money that they got from their crimes in the bank account or in the special saving accounts that are there to build houses or so. They were living a normal life as the middle class, like plumbers or carpenters and jobs like that. And it was more like a man's kinds of thing, or sports clubs or so. So instead of going hunting or bowling or what, they went out and they committed crimes, and it was very hard to discover them. But finally they were discovered. Those cases stuck in my mind because they're, in a way, they're very interesting, because it would show you that evil is not only conditioned by your upbringing, but it's also a temptation that is there for everybody in their life.
But you don't know anything about the upbringing of these people.
No. Maybe one could find out something, but wouldn't it be more interesting to not try to find a cause for what they do, but rather root the fact in the decision that they made to become either evil or good?
Some Catholic or something would say, like, they are possessed by the Satan or something like that.
I think they were just in a club, and there is this moment where you are you courageous to do this or that? Do you dare? And there is a moment where you consider everybody else an idiot and yourself a genius.
How far is the limit from being criminal and non-criminal? Where's the border?
Very distinct, I think. It's a question of decision.
Yeah, killing is one thing, but when we have an army and you're ordered to kill, are you a criminal then?
Well, it's a difference if you get an order to do something or if you decide to do something. As you could do an order willingly or reluctantly.
You're still doing it.
Yes, but for me it still counts the attitude that you have towards it.
When you're selling a weapon?
You're already a criminal. You see, it starts with little things. And there's
you have a legal shop in selling weapons in the States, for example. Are you a criminal?
Yes. You're already a criminal. You're a criminal in the moment where you do something evil. And you know that you do it, and you know.
You know by heart whether you're doing something which is criminal or not.
Yeah, you might say by heart. It's a sentimental way of, by brain, I would say. Huh? It's not so much a heart decision. It's, I would say the brain decides more than the heart. Huh?
Yeah, the decision, yes, but the moral guidance kind of...
Moral on guidance here. Comes from the brain.
Yeah, yeah, we're here.
So moral guidance comes from the brain. This we heard from Martin, which a story he told in the tram at 3 o'clock in the night about a kidnapping in Munich. And we also had some sounds from the underground where there were loads of foreigners and some foreigners who didn't speak any of the German language. Just some impressions of that, and especially impressions of... Because I think it's interesting to see how important it is to integrate the foreigners, and we're getting all these issues here in Dublin as well. But we don't have the underground, we don't have a tram system like they have in Munich, so there's something to do where we could take their example. And we also heard Greg Roach on some moral guidance in the media we take into us, like the computer games. There is a lot of improvement to do there as well. And, well, so I hope this was a bit food for thought. If you're more into action, there is some protest needed at the Iranian embassy. It's going to be on tonight, Thursday, the 11th of August, at 6:30 in Blackrock at the 72 Mount Marion Avenue. This protest is against child executions after the two recent teenage executions. Today, Thursday of 11th of August, there's also two demonstrations against Shell. One on the Shell to Sea demonstration at the Department of Communications, Marine and Natural Resources on 2931 Adelaide Road. And there's also a Shell picket at the Shell garage on Marion Road near near the train station. And this is all at 6 o'clock. Okay, so if you have any comments, please tell us by email on majorityworld@nearfm. And I thank you for listening, and I hope to hear you next week again. Thank you.